Hello, welcome. So this is an introduction to food allergies and cross-contamination overview made for the Professional Development Task Force at Wiley Education Services. Some of you may know that the Louisville office is kept peanut-free, but you may not know why that is. And if you weren't aware that it's a peanut-free building, now you know. There are signs up throughout the building as a reminder, and it is worked into the HR new hire training information for those who are in the Louisville office. So to get us started, I felt a little funny putting my face on a slide, but I figured it could be nice to have a face to put to the presenter for this PowerPoint. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. My name is Zoe Slaughter. I do have a severe peanut allergy, and I've been at the Learning House, now bought by Wiley, for 3 years. I started in retention as an advisor, and I've spent the last year and a half in marketing as a content marketing lead. The Learning House Wiley has really gone above and beyond in accommodating my peanut allergy compared to past employers that I've had, so I've been really grateful for that. I was born with my severe peanut allergy. This was back when a lot less was known about food allergies in general, before this was kind of a food allergy epidemic that hit. So I do consider my food allergy to be airborne, and I know that I react to trace amounts. The severity of my peanut allergy has always been bad, but it's definitely progressed and morphed over time. In this presentation, I'll be speaking from my own personal experience, giving a glimpse into the food allergy world from my own point of view. Food allergies are unfortunately becoming only more and more common, so I'm sure many listening have food allergies themselves or know someone with a food allergy. I really want to make it clear that I'm not a doctor or an allergist. I'm not trying to diagnose anybody, and most importantly, I'm not trying to speak about food allergies as if they're all the same. One tricky thing about food allergies is that they aren't a one-size-fits-all. One person's experience can differ greatly from another person's, and even just for one person like myself, each allergic reaction won't necessarily manifest itself the same way each time. I'll be providing as many statistics and facts as possible throughout this presentation, keeping the main emphasis on prevention and actionable ways that people can help. And while I know navigating the world with a peanut allergy best, the information in my slides should really translate across the board for all food allergies. So with that in mind, let's get started. So you might be wondering, what exactly is a food allergy? A food allergy is defined as a medical condition in which exposure to food triggers a harmful immune response. What this means is that the immune system actually of an allergic person decides to attack proteins in food that are normally harmless to others. So the proteins that trigger the reaction are kind of known as being allergens. The most important food allergy signs and symptoms are represented in this slide. So you'll see hives, swelling, itchy, warmth, nausea, anxiety, headaches, stomach cramps. Food allergy symptoms usually develop within a few minutes to 2 hours after eating the offending food. However, delayed reactions can occur up to 4 to 6 hours or even longer. The symptoms of an allergic reaction of food you'll see in this slide can really range drastically from mild to severe, with the most severe being anaphylaxis, which can lead to death. It is easy to confuse a food allergy with food intolerance, which is also known as like a food sensitivity. These are definitely bothersome and frightening, but food intolerances do not involve the body's immune system. So that is the key difference that separates the two, food allergies versus food intolerances. For my presentation, you'll walk away knowing the most common food allergies, what cross-contamination is and the dangers of it, how to administer epinephrine, surprising places that you may find hidden food allergens. I'll tell you about food labeling laws in the US and other countries. I'll provide tips and tricks to help keep those with food allergies safe and how to be an ally, resources to learn more if you're interested, and what's on the horizon for food allergy cure development. So if you forget all this, no worries, you'll have this PowerPoint presentation to refer back to, but you'll also have an opportunity to ask questions at the end of this presentation. So to start us off, I have some quick statistics to go over. Researchers estimate that 32 million Americans have food allergies. In that, 5.6 million children with food allergies are under the age of 18. So that's 1 in 13 children that have food allergies, or roughly 2 in every classroom. And that's 1 in 10 adults that have food allergies. About 40% of children with food allergies are allergic to more than one food. More than 170 foods have been reported to cause allergic reactions. In the U.S., there are 8 major food allergens that we are required to label for, and those are milk, egg, peanut, tree nuts, wheat, soy, fish, and shellfish. Statistically, a food allergy reaction sends someone to the ER every 3 minutes. claim lines with the diagnosis of anaphylaxis food reactions have increased 377% between 2007 and 2016, so this is why many call it a food allergy epidemic. Comparing the U.S. to other countries and their food labeling laws, Australia labels for 9 food allergens, Canada requires labeling for 11 food allergens, the EU requires labeling for 14, Korea labels for 14, and based on what I could find, they label for peach, pork, and tomato, which I found interesting, so those might be some more common food allergies there. If you know someone with a food allergy, if you have a food allergy, or if you have a child with an allergy and plan to travel, it's really good to know the labeling laws of wherever you're going. And also, if they speak another language, to know the many versions and alternative words that could encompass your allergen. I know when I traveled to France, there were over 6 words in French alone that could be used to label various peanut ingredients on food labels, so I had a little cheat sheet printout that I carried around with me. So this is a visual representation that was made by an MD named Julie Brown, and I found it really unique because it shows how small of an amount of an allergen it could take to cause deadly anaphylaxis. So if you're unable to see the screen for whatever reason, it's 1 milligram of peanut that can cause lethal anaphylaxis, and it shows a diagram of a dime, the currency, and it takes up maybe like a 1/20th of that dime. Like I mentioned before, each food allergic individual is different, so it can absolutely require less protein than the 1 milligram shown. It's also nearly impossible to pinpoint how much of an allergen someone ingested after they've started to have a reaction. So this, I felt like, is a very powerful visual representation to kind of show what those in the food allergy community are up against every day. Now this one is a different visual representation that I found breaks down the amount of protein in the average peanut kernel. So I would imagine this might translate similarly for other nut allergies. An average peanut is made up of 300 milligrams of peanut protein. So to put this into perspective, that first visual representation by MD Julie Brown was representing just 1 milligram of peanut protein. So each peanut contains 300 times the amount that's been proven to cause lethal anaphylaxis in a person. I feel like I must look like a germaphobe to the outside world because I'm constantly trying to wipe surfaces, items, wash my hands, and really not touch my face. And this is due to those trace amounts that are shown here in this representation. Trace allergen amounts are similar to germs in a way because they are microscopic, they spread easily in a quick amount of time, and they are virtually undetectable, but they are very dangerous to some people like myself. This next graphic list gives an idea of some common alternatives to the top 8 food allergens in the U.S. The first foods listed are the items that actually contain the allergen, so you'll see things that contain gluten are like wheat germ, bran, bulgur, barley, and so on. Then you'll see in dark green the swap for section that lists ideas for alternative food items, items that you can replace the allergen. You can eat to replace the allergen, excuse me. If you need help finding ideas to replace peanut butter or bring something alternative to peanuts into work, this might help. So one popular alternative right now to peanut butter is sun nut butter, which is made out of sunflower seeds. I think one large part of its popularity right now is that it's not made from a tree nut either, so it's a good kind of all-encompassing nut-free alternative, and apparently it does taste similar to peanut butter. So if you're unable to see the screen, these alternatives listed in this slide are not factoring in cross-contamination with other foods, so any of the foods, listed here might be processed on shared equipment with your allergen, so that's just something to keep in mind. But it does show, for example, dairy is listed. It tells you what dairy is, cow's milk, cheese, cottage cheese, half and half, pudding, yogurt, and then it gives a swap. So almond milk or other nut milks, coconut milk, dairy-free chocolate chips, sorbet for ice cream, those types of things. So this may seem like a given, but you can't just tell by looking at food if it's safe to eat. You always have to check the ingredients label. While reading labels does take extra time, it's an important part of managing your own allergies day to day if you have a food allergy or if you're giving food to someone with an allergy, like a child, for example. There's a triple check method that you can use if you're able to, and that is checking the label once at the store before buying it, once when you get home and when you're putting it away, and then again before you serve or eat the product. So why do this so many times, you might ask? For one, food allergens might be present in products that you didn't expect. Two, food allergies often change ingredients without telling consumers, so this happens to me a lot. I might find a product that I trust, that's safe, and then I'll check the ingredients label one day and to find that they've changed the ingredients on me and it's no longer safe. Just to give a word on precautionary statements and free from statements or may contain statements, nut free, free from top allergens, I'm doing quotation marks here, air quotes. So these types of statements, you know, I've included in this image here, like may contain on a label. These are completely up to the company to include. So there is no type of regulation around the verbiage here. There's no one checking to see if these are true. Nothing. In the US, it is only a requirement for them to label if it actually contains the allergen purposefully. So it's not required to label if it was made on shared equipment right before making the product that someone's eating. So, you know, if you're allergic to peanut or cashew or egg, it may have been made on that equipment previously, and there are trace amounts that could be in that product without you knowing. So researchers have found that some products made on shared lines actually contain enough allergen to cause an allergic reaction. So I remember there was a story I saw in an online allergy forum where someone had bought a bag of pre-washed spinach and it had almonds mixed in with it due to shared equipment lines at the facility. So that's an example of, you know, facility level cross-contamination. In my opinion, the U.S. labeling laws really need to get much more strict on cross-contamination in facilities and labeling transparency to prevent this from happening. And they also need to regulate the verbiage that's used and the false claims that can be made on products such as nut-free when it isn't. I came across this conflicting yogurt label that's listed here in the photo. So if you're unable to see for whatever reason, it's a yogurt cup. It says nut-free, soy-free, gluten-free on the front. You flip it over to the back and it says made in a facility that contains nuts. So just to reiterate, the only labeling requirement is if the product actually contains the allergen on purpose. So you really have to do your research if you want to learn anything more. And you cannot blindly trust, you know, a nut-free label or a free-from-top-allergens label. The way that I most often find comfort in eating packaged products is by reaching out directly to the company and asking if peanuts are in the facility, and then I will either use that product or I won't based on what they say. Often people won't tell me. They don't have to disclose that information if peanuts are in the facility or on shared equipment, so that's just something to point out. I found a lot of websites now have information about what allergens are present in the facility or on their websites under their FAQs type section. So I do hope this trend carries on. It's really helpful. I often will still email the company and thank them for having the information on their website and then maybe talk to them and make sure that it's up to date. I do personally trust labeling that states kind of what's in the facility at this point. Usually I feel comfortable enough if it says like this product was produced in a facility with wheat and eggs, no peanuts were present in the facility, or this product was produced in a peanut-free facility. I do tend to look for those when shopping in stores and I will eat them. So even with taking all of these precautions and doing your research with labeling, it does not guarantee a food allergy reaction won't occur. And this is because of product recalls and also cross-contamination. So I'll get into that more now. So I've talked a little bit already about what cross-contamination is, but I want to start at the beginning. So I often give the example of using a knife in a peanut butter jar and then using the same knife in a jelly jam jar. Another example would be then cleaning the peanut butter knife with a sponge and then using the same sponge that's got peanut butter on it to clean other plates, utensils, cups, etc., and then contaminating those. So this can go for any allergen. It could be a shared butter knife, if someone has a dairy allergy, and so on. With that in mind, cross-contamination is when a food you are not allergic to is tainted with a food that you are allergic to. If you can't see the screen, it is a graph that I created to have as a reference for if you're preparing food for someone with a food allergy. It does not mean that someone will feel comfortable eating it if they have an allergy, but it's a good kind of starting ground to get into the mindset of someone with a food allergy. So in the center, it says, before prepping food for someone with a food allergy, please keep in mind, you know, clean surfaces, your hands, tools before you prepare food. Use a non-contaminated sponge. Clean any foods that you need to. Keeping any food separate while preparing if you need to. Clean your hands, silverware, dishes before you serve it. Clean food storage containers and so on. So being severely allergic to a food, I've learned that people often assume most settings are safe for me to be in and that I'm just kind of moving through life to be mindful of what I eat, and that's my primary focus. While I am mindful of what I'm eating and putting in my body, cross-contamination of an allergen is a much larger and more difficult aspect to control. And I often find that cross-contamination ends up being really my main struggle. So I'll give you some examples of this in the next slide and some ways that you can help. So thinking back to the trace amounts representation that I showed of the 300 milligram peanut, here's a list of some places to think about how you may be contaminating surfaces or objects with an allergen. If you've just eaten a bag of mixed nuts outside of the office on a walk and you're coming back in, you could likely contaminate multiple spots and surfaces on your way back to your desk. For example, the door handle, elevator buttons, sink handles, a shared pen, the printer buttons, a shared office space table in a conference room, etc. If someone severely allergic to those allergen particles touches those same surfaces and then touches their lip or their eyes, that could be enough to ignite a serious, deadly allergic reaction. So this is a prime example of cross-contamination without eating being involved. It was just from a contaminated surface. This also may help put into perspective the dangers of having nuts served on airplanes and really just the dangers of living with a severe food allergy in general and how easy it is for someone to go into a reaction and ultimately not know why. So in this slide, I have a list of places to think about how you might be contaminating surfaces or objects with an allergen. Your phone, playground or gym equipment, door handles and cabinet doors, elevator buttons, seats and chairs, specifically maybe the armrest, the fabric, shared tabletops and surfaces, clothing, shared books, pencils, pens, supplies, sink handles, money, home, vehicle. So if people have pets, which I'll get into in a little bit, their home can be contaminated, you know, in full. Bringing outside food into an allergen-free space, kitchen sponges, library books, and food from the grocery, such as packages and produce. So here are some things that you can do to help prevent cross-contamination and the spreading of allergen particles. So kind of, for one, you can avoid consuming an allergen if you know someone you're in contact with is allergic to it. Be sure to wash your hands, use wet wipes after eating in shared or public spaces. Be mindful when touching shared spaces and items with allergen particles or dust. So if you just ate shucked some peanut shells, wash your hands, try to make sure that you're not touching things around you where someone else could touch the space and then go into a reaction. Thinking about non-food items that you may use that contain allergens, such as giving your dog peanut butter treats at the dog park or giving your dog peanut butter daily with their medicine and having someone over that's allergic to peanut butter, likely a lot of surfaces will be contaminated, so it's good to give that person a heads up. Another thing you can do is just speak up and raise awareness about the dangers of food allergies and cross-contamination. If you see someone eating a common allergen like peanuts and know someone nearby is allergic, you know, let them know so that they can be aware and protect themselves. Or if you see someone eating an allergen in an allergen-free space, let the person eating it know that there's someone allergic nearby and that there might be an allergen that's been eaten. You can tell the person allergic that, so that way they can protect themselves. So it does sound extreme, but it really can be a difference between life and death. And lastly, knowing the signs of an allergic reaction and how to assist. So we'll be getting into this in the next slide. So right now there's no cure for food allergies, so the best suggestion they have is avoidance and prevention. If you do have a food allergy and have a more mild allergic response, Benadryl and other antihistamines can help control some allergic responses. However, for a severe response involving anaphylaxis, epinephrine is required. So what is epinephrine? It does come in multiple forms, so the most commonly known are EpiPens and AuviQ, but there are other brands available. The only difference between any of these brands is the packaging and the ease of use, so it's not the medicine or the dosage. For a time, I had the CVS brand of one, and it was literally a long needle with a long packet of instructions, so if you can get EpiPens or AuviQ, it's definitely more user-friendly and a little less scary to administer, but ultimately, it's the same thing, so it's an injection that goes into your upper thigh. You'll see that epinephrine is also called adrenaline, so that's something we likely have all heard of and are familiar with. For a long time, I did not know that those two were the same. So adrenaline is a hormone that opens your airways and narrows your blood vessels. epinephrine, aka adrenaline, is released naturally in our bodies during acute stress. So it's the same thing that we feel when we're experiencing that fight or flight. You do always have to be taken to a hospital after you've been administered epinephrine. So they will need to monitor your vitals, your heart rate, and there is a chance of a secondary reaction returning without you being re-exposed to the allergen. So epinephrine is not a guaranteed cure, and it can also often take multiple injections. So I personally carry 4 epinephrine injectors at all times, because the only time I've really gone into full anaphylaxis, it took me 3 and I was at an allergist. So they gave me like a steroid injection and oral medicine, and told me that it could definitely take up to 4 if I were alone. It's also important to know that too much epinephrine or adrenaline in our bodies can cause other life-threatening issues such as a heart attack. So it is not to be used lightly. It's truly a last resort when someone is actually experiencing anaphylaxis, and you always have to call 911. One thing people often don't know about epinephrine, even though it does state it on the packaging, is that it does need to remain temperature controlled. So your prescription can expire or change if it's exposed to freezing temperatures or if it gets too hot, like if it's left in a hot car in the summertime or taken to like a music festival. I actually keep the 4 of mine in a temperature controlled carrying case that I keep in my purse, and it's the same type that is meant for insulin. So here's a quick video that I'll play in a moment that explains how to administer an EpiPen. I chose to show you this EpiPen version of the video since these are actually, or they're typically the standard prescribed, and AviQ has a built-in recording. So it's as if you had this video with you when you administered it, which is super cool. They'll go over this in the video somewhat, but you want to inject the epinephrine where the person's arm falls on their thigh. So if they were standing upright, wherever like my hand naturally lands on my side is going to be the right spot to inject it. Also, this is an Australian video, so instead of dialing 000, it would be 911 if you're in the United States. It also states in this video to hold the EpiPen in place for 3 seconds, but you'll want to check with the epinephrine instructions, because sometimes I've found that it's 3 seconds. Sometimes people will say 10 seconds. So just something to keep in mind, and I'll start the video. For those of you, I'm just going to pretend I've started the video and then move on. I'm sorry, it looks like my notes have gone away. Let's see if I can get them back here. The video started and kind of threw off my slides here. Okay. So now that you know how to administer epinephrine, this image is a follow-up to the video. So it basically tells you the same information, but written form. So you could print it out if you wanted to. It's the acronym THINK FAST. So it's FAST representing face, airway, stomach, and total body. So that's always kind of easy for me to remember an acronym. So you're thinking face symptoms such as hives, itching, redness, swelling of the face, such as your lips or your tongue, your airway symptoms. So if you're having trouble breathing, swallowing, nasal congestion, or even sneezing. Stomach symptoms, which would be like stomach pain, vomiting, diarrhea, and then total body symptoms are the things that you'll want to look for in anaphylaxis. So, you know, all of those: hives, itching, swelling, sense of doom, loss of consciousness, weakness, diarrhea, you know, those are kind of the main symptoms. Let's see here. It does list 6 steps that you can do. So lying the person on their back, if you're injecting epinephrine. I won't read the whole slide to you. So I do feel like anaphylaxis can be tricky to explain since it's a matter of monitoring and making a judgment call. But in short, it is an allergic reaction that is causing a life-threatening symptom. So I do list some of those here in this slide. Normally they say if you're experiencing 3 or more, then you're having an allergic reaction and you need to seek treatment. It is hard to know if you're having a reaction that can be controlled with Benadryl or not. So that's one real difficulty having a food allergy. You have to really pay attention to the signs and stay on top of how they're progressing. To that, I always say to be prepared with antihistamines, always have your epinephrine on hand, and tell someone if you think you're having a reaction. the last part is really important. So often when someone's having a reaction, they'll go to the restroom if they're having stomach problems or if they're afraid and they want to go somewhere to calm down, maybe splash water on their face, or if they're developing like noticeable hives or lip swelling, you want to kind of get away. That's really the last thing that you should do. If you know someone's having an allergic response, or if you feel a food allergy response coming on, or any response if you get stung by a bee, please do tell someone so that they know you're in a restroom and can monitor you from afar. So if a reaction comes on quickly, you don't want to be alone in there by yourself. That's one story I've read online multiple times, is that people run to the restroom without telling anyone, and I can fully understand why. I've done it myself, but knowing this trend can be a matter of saving someone's life, so it's really important to spread awareness and not seek solitude if you're the one having a reaction. So this slide says, you know, signs of anaphylaxis, constriction and tightening of the airways, rapid pulse, dizziness. So you're always going to want to communicate to someone if you think you're having this type of a severe reaction. So with all of this in mind, prevention is key. So the most important thing is to focus on preventing a reaction in the first place. By being aware of prevention, we can lessen reactions for allergic individuals, which are expensive, scary, and truly life-threatening. So this is the part of the presentation where I'll be getting into non-food products that contain common allergens. Oral medications follow the same rules as food, so while they are required to be labeled for the top 8 allergens in the U.S., they don't have to list if peanuts or another allergen are on shared equipment. So you'll see a photo here listed of eardrops with peanut oil as an ingredient. The allergens also don't have to be in bold or anything to make them stand out, and they may be referred to as their Latin term. So you'll see here that the peanut oil is known as arachis oil, A-R-A-C-H-I-S oil, so that's its Latin term. I've seen inhalers that you would, you know, orally take, or hair oils with arachis oil as an ingredient. I've read stories online about skin creams containing the Latin term for almond oil that have been prescribed to people with tree nut allergies in their files. So you really have to be on the lookout at all times, not just related to food and what you're ingesting. In the final slide coming up, I have a resources page that links to my website, and it does list the Latin names for nuts. Non-food products that aren't made to be ingested do not have to be labeled for allergens, and they do not have to fully disclose any ingredients lists. So even though things like lipstick are meant to be applied to your mouth, makeup isn't required to be labeled for allergens, neither is hair dye, skin hair products such as shampoo, conditioner, deodorant, soaps, toothpaste that goes in your mouth, cleaning supplies such as Swiffer dust wipes and various cleaning sprays often contain food-derived ingredients. So do moisturizing facial tissues, pet food, pet treats, bird seed, bagged soil, modeling clay, which usually contains wheat, finger paint or face paint, which usually contains egg. I recently heard that our skin absorbs things 10 times faster than our body ingesting it, so that's something to keep in mind. You know, it is a real problem that these allergens are not required to be labeled for by manufacturers. It's really hard to get information from these companies. I typically, you know, personally have not gotten responses when reaching out, or I'll get a super vague copy and paste type of statement saying, yes, it is possible that any allergen in the product could be in it. So basically, it's not helpful. They don't want to give any information. So I usually try to stick with products that are more natural, which can be problematic in itself since food, nut oil, is natural, like walnut shells are natural. But also smaller companies are usually nicer. They'll usually disclose to me what's in the product. So that's normally kind of the route that I take. A second scary issue with food is food recalls. So these are truly the worst because it's completely out of a person's control and it's unavoidable. So no matter how careful you are, food recalls can happen, and it's an example of a way that you just cannot be fully in control at all times. I've even tried to grow most of my food from my own garden, and even then I can share stories of neighborhood squirrels contaminating my garden with peanuts from bird seed feeders. So I really try to never feel fully comfortable when I'm eating, so that I'm always kind of acting preventatively and with caution. So back to food recalls. There's a recall image here shown in my slide that represents a massive flour recall that was in 2016 with the company Greencraft. I'd never heard of them before, but when I did was because they are apparently a major supplier of flour that was grown at the same site as peanuts. So it was on the same ground as their wheat, and people started reacting to it. Since the company is a distributor, it contaminated all types of products. So it's not like they have one company and it was just this one company impacted. It was like all Kroger and Walmart and Target donuts, all pizza crusts that were at those stores, you know, many pastas, millions of items that were shipped and utilized by other companies all around the world. So this is just one example of a product recall. And these do happen quite frequently related to allergens. So it's something to be aware of and on the lookout for sure. Also, if you feel like you're having a reaction to a food that says it does not contain your allergen or an ingredient that you're allergic to, you know, it's good to just trust your intuition. You might be having a reaction to a product that will later be recalled. So I do hope that this was informative and beneficial. If you're interested in learning more, this truly was kind of a overview and meant to not get too specific. So I grouped together in this last slide my top website recommendations and attached a link to my personal peanut allergy blog called Invisibly Allergic. With Halloween coming up, it's always kind of a tough holiday for me candy-wise, so I've included a link to something called the Teal Pumpkin Project. The teal pumpkin is becoming a widely recognized Halloween symbol to food allergy communities and beyond. It represents allergy-safe food or non-food Halloween treats, which are my favorite, like stickers, temporary tattoos. I guess you kind of have to think about what those contain, though, so maybe that was a bad example. But they even released, the Teal Pumpkin Project does, a map of homes in the neighborhood with non-food treats or allergen-friendly treats. So I added my home to the map the last couple of years. I've also linked some peanut and gluten sensors that are expensive but available to buy. So you'd order or buy your food and then take some of the food and put it in the sensor. But the sensor is kind of just like the test that some food manufacturers use to test for allergen proteins at their facility level. So those are out there, but they're not as good as they might be one day. You still have to buy the meal or buy the product and test it. So it's not the best system at this point. There is a top 8 allergen-free and gluten-free bakery in Louisville, Kentucky, where I am located and live, called Annie Mae's Sweet Cafe, and there's many other cities that have similar bakeries and cafes that are opening up. So this is just great to see, and I love seeing allergen consciousness happening in the community. People have asked me why I haven't done oral immunotherapy, which is also known as OIT, and what my thoughts are on it. So there is an allergist in Louisville that recently started doing OIT trials, so it could be a placebo or an actual microdosing of your allergen, but you're not told. I've gone into anaphylaxis from having a scratch test to peanuts at an allergist, so I don't feel like I'm a candidate after talking with different places who do OIT. So it really is up to everyone's own comfort level, but I'd rather avoid and prevent until it's a little bit more known and studied long term. And that's just my own personal opinion about it. I try to avoid as many reactions and have read articles showing, you know, with these OIT trials and studies, people often have many reactions and responses, and that's what I'm trying to avoid. So I am very hopeful that it could lead to food allergy cures one day. I'm really happy that it's out there and something that's in the works. There are food allergy cures being worked on all around the world, which is very promising. So I'm open to, you know, that coming up with something one day that I'd be comfortable trying. I am open to any questions at this time, or feel free to log off, and I really appreciate you listening. Does anyone have any questions or comments?